Hi, everybody. You're listening to the final installment of my three-part series devoted to game designers and the design process. In this edition, I talk with Jonathan Blow, creator of the highly acclaimed Braid, and a new game called The Witness, which is slated to appear next year. We discuss a wide array of topics, including John's reaction to our reaction to Braid, and he talks about his goals for The Witness, and he's refreshingly open about his discoveries along the way, as well as his missteps as the development of that game has proceeded. John also talks about why he's grown uncomfortable characterizing his projects as art games, and he has some interesting things to say about the costs of secrecy in the game industry. It's a fascinating conversation, I think, and I hope you'll enjoy it. I also encourage you to check out parts one and two of the series featuring Manveer Hare and Matthew Burns, respectively. Those shows are available on my website, brainygamer.com, and on iTunes. So here's my conversation with John Blow. Thanks for listening, everybody, and away we go. I am delighted to welcome Jonathan Blow to the podcast. He needs no introduction to most of you, I'm sure. His game Braid was easily the most talked about game released that year, and I think for part of the next year as well. And it's just a great pleasure, Jonathan. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me. You started the game in 2005 or maybe even December 2004, which if you count how many years is between then and now, is a long time.
It's strange too, because I started Brainy Gamer not much before Braid appeared, and it just became the conversation. You know, I mean, it was just, and you were part of it. It was just the most vivid conversation about a game that I've had since we started, and which I assume must be gratifying to you. On even though maybe some of us stumbled around trying to figure out how to talk about it, the fact that it generated so much conversation must have been gratifying to you.
It's difficult. I have many thoughts about this, right? Or many ways that I feel about it, depending on what day it is. Like, of course, I'm happy that people thought the game was even worth talking about, right? Like, I didn't know that, you know, before it was released. It was very easy to imagine that it would sell a small number of copies and just kind of disappear, right? I had no reason to believe that wasn't going to happen. So it's great that it didn't. You know, it's great that critics liked it too, and it, you know, it got good scores and all that, because we all know how important scores are. But at the same time, yeah, it like the nature of the discussion, I often found really kind of frustrating. And looking back on it, like the pattern that happened is just that a lot of what people talked about was not the stuff that I thought was the most interesting about the game. And the stuff about the game that I thought was most interesting, you know, very few people would notice or talk about. So I got kind of depressed actually for several months after Braid came out. And part of that is probably, you know, I believe there's a well understood psychological phenomenon, right? Sort of a postpartum depression kind of thing. So there was that going on, but there was also just like, you know, wow, I'm making this thing and I'm putting it out into the world in the hopes, you know, maybe sort of as a beacon, like here's something that I think is really interesting, you know, like what does everybody else think? Like, is there somebody out there who thinks it's interesting too? And actually what it ended up doing was made me feel more alone, you know, ideologically than I had felt before releasing it.
Wow.
Which was interesting. But again, it's, you know, the internet is a very, distorted carrier of communication, you know, especially when you look at, like, if I go to the internet and start reading what people say about the game, you know, just to get an idea for like what in general is happening, is the game doing out there in the world? The first thing that's going to happen is most of the comments I read are going to be negative actually. Right. Because that's just the kind of that's kind of what happens on the internet, right? The people who are mad about something or who don't like it are just more motivated to type something in and press the post button, you know. So you kind of have to do all this filtering in your head about what you're reading, and I'm probably better at that now than I was because it was my first like really personal game that I'd ever released.
Sure.
Yeah, I don't know.
You know, it seemed to me that it was. The convergence was interesting to me. It came out at just about exactly the time that this critical community was forming. And part of the challenge, I think, for us was, how do we talk about games? Like, we really, in 2007, 2008, we're just getting around to figuring that out. I mean, if we're not interested in talking about just what's the score that it should receive, or, you know, is it a buy or a rent, or that kind of language. And so I recall that a lot of, it seemed to me, the conversations that occurred were just that. They were less about, say, I'm going to write this, you know, 11-paragraph essay that analyzes the game. And a lot of it was just people talking with each other about how to talk about the game, which, yes, I don't know, struck me as useful, even if it may not have served you as well as you might have hoped. It probably served us.
Yeah, well, that's good, you know. You can't ever predict. You know, you make something and you put it in the world, and it is obviously impossible to really know what the effect of that is ever going to be.
Yeah.
So if there's some kind of good effect, then that's cool, you know.
Well, let's begin with a question I'm sure most the people listening are curious to know, and that's, how's your new game, The Witness, coming along?
It's coming along well, actually. You know, it's been almost 2 years that we've been working on it full time with an actual team. I actually started it a while before that, actually a little bit before Braid was released. You know, so I started in mid to late 2008, just as a prototype kind of a thing. But back then I was still in the mindset of, you know, hey, I'm this guy who like has to type in the whole program by himself and all this. And maybe I'll have somebody helping like David did on Braid, but it'll be like a minor thing. Because, you know, I didn't have money back then or anything. Like, I was broke when Braid came out, you know. So it's funny, too. Like the discourse on the internet all talking about Braid assumes, I don't know, like, assumes a lot of things about me or whatever. And it's like, I'm actually, like, some guy who released a game, you know. So that was still the way I saw myself at that time. But then it turned out both that Braid had done pretty well financially, so I could afford to pay people to help make a new game. But then also, you know, I went off, and in early 2009, I was sort of doing some other ports of Braid, like to the PC and stuff.
Yeah, and it's out for Linux, by the way, just in case people want to know.
It is, yes. If you are interested in that, do go download it, because not very many people have, actually, to date.
Okay.
Yeah, it's kind of more worth doing from an ideological standpoint than actually letting more people play it.
Yeah, absolutely. Apparently. I'll put a link when we post the podcast, because that's cool. I was very surprised to see it, delighted to see that happened.
Yeah, actually, I guess the Humble Bundle is going to be over by the time this airs, huh? But if it weren't, you could have gotten Braid for one penny along with 10 other games. Let me see. So the other thing, you know, I in 2009, I went off and I did a couple of other prototypes of games that I thought were pretty interesting that were more tractable, right? That weren't going to be... Because, you know, the other thing, so The Witness, I had this idea, and it was a grand idea that was very complicated, and it had to be 3D and all this stuff. And not only was it going to be hard to program, but just design-wise, it's very ambitious. And kind of the thing you don't want to do when you've just released a successful game and you have, like, some financial stability and whatnot is to go, you know, go full bore into a crazy, you know, second project that's, you know, it's like bands with their second album or whatever, yeah, you know, and it turns out to be terrible. Yeah. And they go broke. So I didn't want to do that. But it turned out, you know, the more I worked on these prototypes and stuff, that I really did want to do The Witness. I just kept coming back to it in my mind. So, you know, around October 2009, it turned out that, well, I mean, I decided basically that this actually was a good idea, whereas I before thought it wasn't. So I started a new company and put together a small team, and we've been working for almost 2 years, and we've got probably a year left. The real answer to when it's shipping, though, is when it's done, right? Because I don't want to release something that isn't achieving its full potential. But I sort of think a year from now is plausible.
Okay.
At this time, you know, what I've been doing this week and last week is taking the game around to press, right, and showing it to them, even though it's very early, like the graphics are mostly placeholder still, right? The audio hasn't been worked on much, and, you know, we've got temp voice in for the acting and all that. And, but there's 10 hours of gameplay that are at least somewhat refined, because I did the game the same way I did Braid, You know, with Braid, it was an accident, right? So I sat down, I was doing this platformer. I didn't care that much about the art because I knew I was going to try to, you know, have someone help out. But it took years to find somebody actually who I felt would do a good job. You know, David Hellman, I think, only started working on the game after the game won that IGF prize. So like mid to late 2006.
Seriously, I didn't know that. Holy cow.
Yeah, but that was still a substantial part of development, right? Because the game didn't come out till 2008, you know, and so he was working on it for at least a year and a half or something like that. Yeah, you know, because there wasn't an artist on the game and it was all this lousy programmer art, I was very free to, you know, just tear levels up to make them better, split a level into three levels and put one in a totally different world and change it a little bit. And I didn't have to care that like, oh my God, I've just destroyed all this hard work that some artist, you know, spent weeks setting this up to look nice. Because it didn't look nice, right? But it was very playable. And the other thing that was good about it was very unambiguous because, you know, Braid originally was made out of a bunch of rectangles. So you kind of saw very clearly where you could stand and how wide jumps were and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And that served as a barometer when we went and did the real art. We could tell when things were getting more ambiguous, right? And becoming less playable as we made it look better. And whenever I saw that happening, I would have us trim back and make things actually look a little quote unquote worse in order mm-hmm. to be more playable. So like, let's make the edge of this platform a little more squarish, even though it's supposed to be grass or whatever, just so it's clear where you can stand. So all that kind of stuff happened back then. And then coming to this game, I wanted to be able to do that stuff. So we've undergone a development process that's very different from the way people usually do it, where it's been a kind of a gameplay first thing for 2 years, but because it's 3D and that's complicated, you kind of have to do some of the other stuff. You have to have kind of real data in the game, you know, for what your meshes and textures are, because if you don't do that, then you're kind of designing an engine without knowing what kind of load is going to be placed on it at all, right. You know, and then you can't optimize and all that. So we've kind of gone a middle of the roadway where we sort of, you know, one guy on the core team is a 3D artist and he's been making stuff just enough for us to build the game. And a lot of the buildings in the game are just like rectangular boxes that I made in the in-game editor, right? That aren't trying to look cool. And, but it's playable, for, you know, 10 or 11 hours, end to end right now. Apparently that works. You know, earlier this year I tested it at the GDC. Actually, you know, last year I brought the game to PAX very sneakily.
Right. I heard about that. Yeah.
Yeah. And nobody knew what it was. A couple people figured it out. But it didn't, the news didn't get out until after the show was over.
Right.
And people were able to play it and, that was all good, but that was only a certain level of test. Cause at a trade show like that, you know, not many people are going to sit down and play a game for more than like half an hour. Right. Some people did. But even that was cool. Like you're at this loud trade show where like, you know, several blockbuster games are just around the corner and you could be going over to look at that, but you're sitting here playing this totally unmarked, mysterious game that you just found. Like a bunch of people did that. So that was nice. And it showed me that the first, you know, 20 to 30 minutes of the game worked. I didn't know about longer than that. So at the GDC this year, I did a bunch of 1 to 2 hour play tests, usually 1 hour, I guess. And then now when I'm showing it to the press, the way I'm doing it is basically the opposite of the way game companies usually do it. You know, they usually do very heavily guided demos.
Right.
Because games that are not in a state of completion, it's like, oh, let's not show them how wonky the animation is and this and that, so let's avoid all these scenarios. You know, but I'm doing exactly the opposite. I'm just giving them a little couple of minute intro and then I just sit them down in front of the game for 2 hours, if they have that much time, up to 3 hours, and I just walk away. Hmm. And they can come yell at me if the computer crashes or anything, which it generally doesn't. And then I come back after they've played for a couple hours and talk to them. And, it, you know, generally they've had a very interesting time and seem to like the game and all that. So
so you don't watch them play then? You don't?
No.
You leave them alone?
Yeah. I mean, it might kind of be good data for me to see them play. But the thing is, when you're sitting over someone's shoulder watching them, it really changes what it's like to play the game.
Right.
So you're not, because people don't really want to be judged and watched, especially in a game like this. It's a puzzle game. This is funny because I've been talking forever and we haven't said anything about what the game is. let me segue into a very short description of the game so we know what we're talking about. It is a 3D game where you walk around an open world, but unlike most games where open world means we're trying to make the world gigantic, it's a really small and dense open world, sort of the way that Braid was a small and dense platformer world. So if you're in some area and you're playing some puzzles and you decide you want to go somewhere else, you can. There's several places that you could go that are like 10 seconds walk away, literally, and that are interesting and that have a different subject to sort of speak about game rhetorically, you know. And so that happens, you know, there's 10 or 11 hours of single player gameplay. There's audio logs. So there's a story in the game again. It's pretty different structurally than the story in Braid. It's made to be nonlinear. So, you know, in this game, because it's open world, you wander from location to location, and each location is pretty linear. So you have a feeling of progression when you're inside it, like, oh, I'm getting to the end of this location, right? Because you can imagine if you just make a world with like a zillion puzzles and they're unordered, and it just feels very flat, right?
Yeah.
So you go to a location, like a desert ruin, and you wander into this ruin, and you get in through the front door by solving some puzzles, and you get into a basement, and you get into the sub-basement, and then you get deeper and deeper. And then eventually you get to the end, you know, where you get to trigger something signaling that you finished that area. And as you work your way through that area, there will be some audio logs, some of which may be obviously placed and some of which maybe you have to look harder for, that talk about something, you know, related to the story, like some thread of ideas that also sort of resonates with or is in accord with the visual theme of the location and the puzzle theme of the location. So a little bit like Braid that way, but in this game, it's looser. It's a much more sprawling game than Braid, and it's not trying to do everything so precisely. Like Braid in a certain way was very rigid and formal. In like there's the same number of puzzles in every world.
Right.
The text before something I've never seen commented on. Somebody probably has, but the text before each world, at least up to a point in the game, actually conforms to a fairly rigid structure, in which certain things are for sure mentioned and certain things are for sure done. And in this game, it's more like the way the fiction interplays with the, you know, with the puzzle theme or with the location theme or the type of building that you're in is it's opportunistic, where there's certain things that are done, but they're not mandatory. And so you kind of almost don't know what to expect about how those things are going to relate when you enter a new area. And so that provides another kind of variety, you know, as you go from area to area. Mm. Anyway, so it's kind of like that.
Well, I was actually let me I'll segue here a little bit, but it's not far.
Sure.
The homepage for the new game, The Witness, is very spare. I don't know why, but I never visited it until I knew we were going to speak, and so I popped over there, and it contains an extended quotation from Richard Feynman, who I take it is one of your heroes. He's one of mine, and I take it he's one of yours.
He's certainly one of the heroes of the game.
Okay. So, and it's from, it's interesting. It's from his essay, The Uncertainty of Values, which, oddly enough, we are using this essay in this course that I'm teaching called Enduring Questions, which could be a subtitle for your game, I think, from what I understand. But anyway, if you don't mind, would you mind if I just read a section of that quotation from Feynman?
Sure, go ahead.
And then I'd love for you to talk about why you chose that passage as a kind of landing site for the witness.
Yeah.
I hope I don't read this poorly. It is a great adventure to contemplate the universe beyond man, to contemplate what it would be like without man, as it was in a great part of its long history, and it is in a great majority of places. When this objective view is finally attained, and the mystery and majesty of matter are truly appreciated, to then turn the objective eye back on man, viewed as matter, to view life as part of this universal mystery of greatest depth, is to sense an experience which is very rare and very exciting. It usually ends in laughter, and a delight in the futility of trying to understand what this atom in the universe is, this thing, atoms with curiosity, that looks at itself and wonders why it wonders. I love that quote, and it struck me that you obviously, you very deliberately chose that to kind of introduce a visitor to the website, to your game. Can you talk a little bit about how that connects?
Yeah, there's a lot to say about
maybe
that,
you
right?
Can't I talk mean, just a little bit, but
you know, I mean, it's a very meaningful and rich quotation, right? So I, you know, while you were reading it, I had all kinds of things that I was like, yeah, I'm going to say this, I'm going to say that, and now I've forgotten it. Let me go to the page for a second so
yeah,
I can
yeah,
glance
yeah.
at it. Which will be difficult, however, as you will note if you press the reload button on the page.
Oh, I haven't done that.
There's actually a randomly chosen from a collection of quotes. Not a large collection.
Okay, yes. Okay.
But about 10 of them.
Yeah, now I'm seeing a totally different one here. Okay, yeah.
I'm getting every quote except the one that we're talking about. there's another Feynman quote. I've gotten that one 4 times. Random number generators. There's an Einstein quote. There's the same Feynman quote. What happened?
See, maybe it's just personal to me. There's some, you know, some odd algorithmic.
Okay, I got it.
Okay.
All right. So let me talk a little bit. So there are certain ways in which the witness is not anything like Braid, but there's a lot of ways in which it is. Like, I think anyone who has a feeling for game design, who looks at the two games, will kind of see a lot of commonalities. You know, even though the game mechanics are completely different, right? And so one of the core things about Braid was the what if question, right? It's structured into a bunch of worlds, and you go into a world, and the world asks the question, essentially, what if time behaved in a certain way? What are the consequences of that? And, you know, the puzzles in Braid serve as illustrations of those consequences. Now, that was a pretty interesting and fun thing in that game. But it's also sort of a made-up thing, right? Like, we don't really have time that goes forward when you walk to the right and goes backward when you walk to the left. Now, on the other hand, and some of what I'm about to say is sort of post hoc rationalization. Like, you know, when I sit down and make a game and I'm all being creative and stuff, like, some things I just know are right and I don't know why.
Right.
But I think my subconscious knows why, or at least has a good feel for it. And then my conscious mind sort of figures it out later because it's slower. And less intelligent, but the thing about the witness, the original idea behind it was, I can't exactly say what it was, because it involved sort of a magic moment of gameplay that I thought was going to be really great, but to say what it is a massive spoiler, right? It's something that I want players to discover for themselves. But then around it, I sort of thought of this structure. Okay, you're going to be on an island. There's going to be a small number of locations that are heavily themed, you know, in the tradition of games like Myst and like that, right? And one of the things that comes with that tradition, that back then was probably an accident of the technology, right? But is that you're in this very lonely place where very few things really animate, and there's nobody really to talk to. People were here and they built things for strange purposes, and now you don't know what that was all about anymore. And you're trying to find out, right? And you're sort of an ominous feeling. And so one of the things that this game does is it inherits that that mood and makes it its own. You know, it does something a little bit different, but that feels inspired by that. But it also starts to talk about... wow, this is really a long tangent in terms of getting back to this quote. But why might one strand oneself on a strange island where there is nobody else, right? Where there are a bunch of strangely designed things that appear to be designed for very specific purposes that you need to figure out, right? Now I'm trying to figure out how to say this without spoiling the end of the game. But let's just say that it might be useful, a useful way to look at the universe, to get away from, you know, people go on silent retreats sometimes, right? Where they go up into the mountains for weeks or months, and they're not going to talk to people, you know, or they're a monk in a monastery and they're taking a vow of silence. And it's a way of clearing your mind.
Yeah, I just got back from one, I have to tell you. I just got back 3 days ago from one.
Yeah, I did one a couple months ago. I'm trying to do at least one a year because they're very good. And what happens, right, is when your mind is clear, you're able to see certain things more clearly, or you're just able to see things that didn't occur to you before. And you know, not as a matter of trying to see them, but just like things can occur to you that wouldn't have occurred if your mind were busy. Right. And that's not the only effect of going. I don't want to trivialize silent retreat. Right. Because it's actually a very deep pursuit in which a lot of things can happen. But this sort of study that Feynman's talking about in this quote is part of the heart of the game. And so when you look at the puzzles in The Witness, they are in many ways sort of the answers to what if questions. But the what ifs being asked are things that are already true about our real world. So it's not so much what if anymore, but like, look what happens when, you know, look what happens when a perspective is used in a certain way, mm-hmm. because that's just what happens in 3D space, right? Mm-hmm. Look what happens when light travels in a straight line and then reflects off surfaces and creates glare. Or, you know, look what happens if you have this mathematical abstraction where there are these very simple symbols that behave in a certain way, and you combine them into sort of the same problem, the same domain, and they interact with each other, right, and create something more than the sum of their parts. So there's something, you know, and this goes to the title of the game. There's something about your role as a player, as being an observer of these things, right, and you're an observer in a lonely place as opposed to an observer in a place full of people, because the focus is on the phenomena and the, like, what is the basis of this world that we live in? What's it about and what's it for and why might we be here? And you know, what's the point of walking around in 3D space and seeing things and hearing things? And so it's that kind of question that the game is about. You know, and in addition to establishing mood, one thing that this setting enables is just to create the quietest possible space, just in terms of like things happening, right? Imagine actually playing the game as being a little bit like being on a silent retreat, but it's one with a lot of puzzles in it, which isn't like most of them. I guess Zen silent retreat is a little bit like that.
Yeah, I mean, there's a brutality to meditation after a certain period of time. it can be devilishly painful, actually. Yeah.
So it's the gameplay is actually a little bit like that. And if you refresh the page and get some other quotes, you'll actually see a number of things that maybe come at this idea or related ideas from different angles.
You've said that you've described The Witness as a modern adventure game, and you mentioned Myst but you've also described adventure games as broken, fundamentally broken. What do you hope to preserve from adventure games as we know them, and what do you intend to change about them?
Okay, here's the part where I'm inevitably going to make negative statements about adventure games, get flamed all over the internet. So I'll just say before this that, you know, I actually grew up on adventure games, sort of. You know, my first games that I played were in the arcade and on the Atari 2600 and stuff back in those days. But the first games that I actually like really loved to play were Infocom games on home computers. And maybe before that, there were a couple Scott Adams adventures on, like, I had a TRS-80 color computer that those were on and stuff. But those were really interesting games, but they're unplayable by modern standards, really. Like, you know, what was considered gameplay back then is now considered just brokenness, right? The issues with text adventures are different from the issues with graphic adventures, and The Witness obviously inherits much more from graphics adventures. But the thing I want to preserve, let's start with that, is something that I feel is being lost a lot in modern games, and that is having puzzles that are actually puzzles. And what I mean by that is that a legitimate puzzle is something that you might never figure out unless you do a good job, right? Because if you're guaranteed to figure it out, then it's kind of, I don't know what it is at that point, right? It's more like an exercise, I guess, or at least exercise isn't the right word in general, but it's the right word for what I feel like most people call puzzles in modern games, right? Because you go, you know, you have your third person action game or whatever, and it goes into focus testing. And anytime, you know, people can't figure out how to get the door open, the puzzle gets simplified or it gets cut or whatever, right? And so what you end up with is things that are ostensibly puzzles, but they're really about, oh, I have to go over here and pull this lever, and then I have to go over there and pull that lever within approximately the same amount of time. And then the door opens and right. I can go on or whatever. And that's fine. But when that's all that's in every game, I kind of wonder what the point is of that. You know, there just aren't many games made that are legitimate puzzle games anymore. Which is also not to say, you know, I'm not trying to say that every game should have puzzles, right? Or that pull the two levers to open the door is not something that should be in games. But, you know, again, I feel like there's a vast richness that we sort of used to have that is no longer being tapped, yeah. right? This idea, like you run an Infocom adventure, and if you even looked at the manual, maybe you have a little bit of guidance into how to talk to it. But the majority of the gameplay experience was just you kind of have to... It's sort of like, you know, you're Robinson Crusoe trapped on this island, and yeah. you have to make the best of it and figure it out. You know, it's not going to tutorialize you all the way through. You know, later on they had built-in clues, but you felt bad for using them. And, you know.
It's interesting, too, because I teach Planetfall to my students. And it's everyone thinks the problem will be, oh, well, it's a text adventure. They don't know how to do text adventures. They don't know what to type. They don't know what the syntax. That's not the problem. They learn that. It's they don't know how to do those puzzles. They don't know how to. I mean, you really have to sometimes draw them out. You have to figure them out. Like, there's an actual puzzle solving dimension to the game that they've never faced.
Yeah, it takes a great deal of player initiative. But also a part of it, though, is, again, like what was considered playable back then is far from considered playable now. You know, so especially, I mean, it's been forever since I played Planetfall, right? But I'm sure it's got the problem that every Infocom game had where, like, you know, the description mentions a bunch of objects and some of them actually exist and some of them don't, right? And you sort of need to figure out what are the important objects. And there's that whole process of, like, what... really are the things I can do in this game, which, you know, nowadays it's expected that a game is very clear about communicating affordances to the player, right? And when it doesn't do that, that's considered bad game design, you know? And then the other thing, and this is maybe more of a stylistic difference, but it's one of the things that I wanted to change, is that modern games, the ones that have gone through all this focus testing, right? Like say platformers or shooters or whatever, they tend to have this idea that there's core gameplay. You know, like in a platformer, I'm running and I'm jumping over monsters or whatever. And that gets varied over the course of the game by me meeting up with different monsters that I have to approach a little bit differently. But the core of what I'm doing is more or less the same activity. And I get better at it as I proceed through the game, right? At the beginning, I'm maybe clumsy and then I can get basic aptitude and then I'm pretty good by the end, maybe. Adventure games never really had that. And, you know, after I said this on a forum, you know, I'll just say Emily Short said she disagrees with this statement. But I don't agree with her. There might be one or two adventure games that sort of have core gameplay where the puzzles happen to be forced by the author to be systemic, mm-hmm. you know, so that they build in complexity and you're doing the same type of thing over and over. But I think that that's an extreme rarity. You know, for the most part, graphics and text adventures are a bunch of puzzles that don't have that much to do with each other, you know, and are sort of just in a world. And the thing that ties them together is the fiction, usually. There are some exceptions to that, like the Enchanter Sorcerer Spellbreaker series was a little bit systemic, you know, in that you had spells that performed certain operations. Mm. You know, those were sort of programmer kind of games, you know. Mm-hmm. But again, it was something that you kind of had to make happen, right? Whereas if you build something like a platformer and you program a little dude that moves around, you have core gameplay before you even make anything interesting. You know, like my dude can move and he can jump.
Right.
So it's like it's against the grain of adventure games to have core gameplay, and it's with the grain of like a platformer or a shooter to have core gameplay. And that's kind of interesting. So what I thought was, what if I take this traditional, you're stranded on an island, you have amnesia, it's a very spooky mystery kind of mood, and instead of a bunch of one-off puzzles, try to introduce a set of core gameplay that's consistent throughout the whole world, right? So that once you get out of the initial area, you know, there's a little training area that like takes 5 minutes, nonverbal training, right? There's no dialogue boxes or anything. And, you know, you get outside, and once people are out of the training area, they pretty much don't do what is one of the major banes of graphic adventures, right? Which is click to find the hotspot everywhere. They just don't do that because for some reason they understand the interactivity that's been given to them in The Witness, and they see the next thing to do, and they know that they can go there and interact with that. So there's no like, well, what, you know, is this door something I should be trying to get through, or is it like non-interactive background art or what, right? Which is a plague of graphic adventures. And the other thing that's sort of a plague of graphic adventures is inventory, and, you know, use A with B. And solving the game is basically going through all the combinatorics of all A and all B, which is very tedious. You know, this game basically has no inventory. You know, as of now, there's a little bit of inventory, but you never, it's just things you pick up and deposit somewhere in a central repository. You don't ever like take them out and use them or anything.
Right.
And so that simplified that. So the interactivity in this game is mostly you just walk places. You look at things, you notice things, and you can go into an interact mode where you're either pushing, you know, you either push a button or pull a lever or whatever with a little cursor, or there are these puzzle panels where you trace a line on the panel and then you either get the puzzle right or wrong. And the interesting thing about the puzzle panels now is that they are a clear, this is kind of where the core gameplay comes in. When you see one of those, it's a clear indication there is a puzzle right there. There is no ambiguity about where the puzzle is, and there's no ambiguity about what you need to do to solve it. All you have to do to solve it is to go into interact mode and draw the proper line from one end of the puzzle to the other. And then the great variety of gameplay in the game comes from knowing exactly what line to draw on that thing. So it's pretty interesting. And I'm actually amazed, as I describe it, you know, it might seem kind of abstract and weird, but I'm actually amazed at how well people take to it. Like, I sort of figured when I designed it, well, when I designed it is an ill-formed span of time. It's like a two-year design span, right? But at some point, I sort of thought, well, you know, a significant number of people just aren't going to be that interested in this game. Because it's puzzles and it's abstract. And that's true for some people, but it's actually a small percentage of people. Like when I've been on this press tour, and I kind of have to guess, you know, from reading people's reactions and when we have conversations after the game, but, you know, more than 90% of people are like really into it and think it's a really interesting game, you know? So that's pretty cool, for especially for a game that is this unconventional. Like, it really doesn't play like anything else.
Right. With placeholder stuff and, you know, like, you're not even giving them the whole thing yet, right?
So yeah, it's clear. I mean, all that's going to get better, right? Just the juice and the production value is going to go up. Yeah. But one thing, so related to that, though, you know, so when I started thinking about this game was, you know, 2008, like I said, and, you know, achievements and reward systems were... they were still on the rise, I think. I'm hoping that they've kind of peaked, but maybe that's an empty hope. But they're, you know, they were still on the rise where, you know, not every first-person shooter had a leveling up system in it, in multiplayer or whatever, right? Mm-hmm. And now they all do. It's like considered a market requirement. And I was almost caught up in this prevailing wave of game design, even though I'd gone and like given speeches about how this isn't a good idea, you know. But because I was making this very like, okay, so I'm making this game where people are going to solve a puzzle and then go and solve another puzzle and then go and solve another puzzle. Like, I'm going to need something to motivate them through that. So I better put some rewards in there. And I almost did that. Like, you were going to go and do a series of puzzles and bing, and then a little lockbox would open and you'd get a little prize out of it. But I just, as I went and designed the game, I sort of just lost heart to implement that because it's always extra implementation complications. And it wasn't clear that these prize, you know, there's going to be a little prize trophy case or whatever, just like every game has today. You know, you could see what you'd collected and stuff. And that was just going to be an implementation headache. And that fortunately, helped me procrastinate long enough on that to decide or to come to my senses and say, you know what, that's really kind of dumb. Like either the gameplay stands up or it doesn't, right? And, you know, I'm an indie developer. I don't need to sell a copy of this game to every person on the planet Earth, unlike some other kinds of games. So I'm just going to do this and see how well it works out, and I'm not going to put in rewards. And so, you know, like Braid, it's very intrinsically motivated in terms of what you do. Yeah, I mean, so there's puzzles and you gain knowledge and you hear more of the story. The story is the most extrinsically motivating thing, I would think, in that typical way, like, oh, I want to know what happens next or whatever, right?
And how did you go about designing that? I mean, did you have a sort of a framework of a story in your mind from the beginning, or is it something that's emerged?
Yeah, I had a framework. And so what's in the game right now is story version 3, which I think is going to be close to what ships. There's been a lot of problems coming up with the story and figuring it out in a way that works. And I'll just say, by way of background, that'll help make this more clear. It was obvious from the very beginning that whatever form the story takes, it is not an entertainment story. Hey, you know what? This is a good time for a 5-minute tangent. And then I'll come back to this.
Go right ahead.
It'll totally set it up, I think, right? You know, when Braid came out, it was very obviously an art game, right? And there were art games before that, I guess, but people, I think, until that year, well, no, actually, that's not true. The number of people who were aware of art games was pretty small, right? And then sometime over 2008, 2009, 2010, that grew. Until now, like, art games is a thing, right?
Yeah, I mean, we didn't really even use that term much before.
Yeah, but here, you know, I'm starting to have a problem with the term, right? And the problem is this. Let's say you're a novelist, right? And you want to write a novel, and you want to write it about something that you think is pretty important or that concerns you or people you know, in that way that most of what we consider great literature was written, right? That's a very blanket, unchecked statement, but let's assume that's true. That's not confusing to us, right? Like, we know there are some books that are like full-on entertainment books, you know, like Da Vinci Code or whatever. And there are some books that are, you know, To Kill a Mockingbird or something like that, right? And when somebody goes and writes a book that's more like To Kill a Mockingbird than it is like Da Vinci Code, we don't think that's weird.
It's not an art book.
And it is not an art book. That is exactly my point, right? If you think art book, right, you think like...
When I think art book, I think a coffee table book with art. Like,
or
that's
that
an
kind
art
of
book.
Thing too.
Right?
Yeah. But you know, and we have this idea that you can have not even a serious book, right? Because it could be like funny, but serious, you know, like not frivolous. And that's a common thing, and it's a respected thing, and it's something we look for as readers, right? Mm. We have that in film too, but maybe to a lesser degree, I guess. I think film is more dominated by like entertainment films, but there's plenty of independent film, right? You might think independent film. You don't necessarily know if an independent film is an entertainment film or a non-entertainment film, but it's more weighted toward non-entertainment film.
Right, right.
Although that's maybe not even true.
Well, but it is. I mean, I think you're onto something when it does feel to me to some degree that art games, or the art game movement as we think about it, is there's a kind of a defensive posture that it exists within. And that's partly because, unlike the cinema, no film goer gets bent out of shape if somebody makes an artistic film or a really highly experimental film.
Yeah.
It doesn't get in anybody's way. It doesn't threaten anybody. But oddly, in video games, and we've talked about this on this show before and on my blog, but you know that a lot of players get very nervous about designers who want to make games artistic because it's like they're ruining the party or they're taking something away from us. There's an odd threat that they pose to some of the very consumers who, you know, sort of help push the medium forward, that where other consumers of media and other kinds of art don't give it a second thought. They don't feel any kind of threat.
Yeah. And, you know, I think part of that, though, is the use of the word art, right? Like, if I were to go to somebody and say, I want to make a game that is relevant to your life and has things to say about your situation that you might take seriously, and after you play it, you might have some interesting ideas that you carry back into real life or whatever, right? That's sort of what I do when I make games. When you say art, right, people tend to think like art galleries and what's in art galleries, which is largely, you know, this is actually a current ongoing discussion on a mailing list that I'm on. Contemporary art, quote, art, unquote, right, as found in galleries, is very detached from what people are interested in their day-to-day lives, right? It's more like, you know, making contemporary art is more like, you know, playing Project Gotham Racing, where you're like, yeah, you're going around the track, but it's like you're trying to get all these kudos and you're like trying to spin your car and do a flip or whatever. You know, you're trying to have your art be referential of something earlier, but like have a twist. And the thing that you're referencing and the thing it references and the thing that that references and the thing that that references are all things that nobody walking into the gallery has any idea about. So they don't understand any of it, right? And so it's interesting for this very small minority of people. And to everybody else, it's like, okay, there's just some guy threw some color on a canvas, like, I don't understand, right? And then even, you know, you can explain those works to them and it still is not that interesting post-explanation. So that might be where part of the hostility comes from. I don't know. Anyway, So for that reason and others, I want to get away from thinking of the stuff that I do as art games, right? Even though that's how I've thought of them for a while. And so The Witness, I've just started thinking about recently, like the past couple of weeks, as, well, it's just, you know, it's just like a book that you would write if you cared about a topic. You know, it's not an art game. It's a game that is not an entertainment game. Or it may be entertaining at times, but it's not, I don't know, it is what it is, right?
Right.
That's pretty much all that I could say about it.
But you do claim yourself, I mean, you do claim the role of artist, right? I mean, you are, and you, well, you've used this phrase yourself, you are trying to speak to the human condition, creating something new, right? Which would seem to me to be a definition of an artist.
Yes, although... I mean, it's difficult because talking about things, or at least I find, in the way that I go and talk about things when I'm giving a lecture or something like that, the way that I speak about them has to be extremely simplified and pared down, because verbal communication is, especially in the short form like that in a lecture, is good for certain things and not good for other things. And that's actually one of the side themes of this game, by the way, is verbal versus nonverbal communication. But... So when I say something like, you know, I'm trying to make things that speak to the human condition, I don't actually do that, right? I don't get up in the morning and say, my goal today is to speak to the human condition.
Sure.
And how
sure.
can I do that? Yeah. Because you can imagine that whatever would get made in that fashion is kind of atrocious. or maybe it can be done well, but I know from personal experience that when I try to do that, it is not done well. And that'll actually tie in a minute when we pop our segue off the stack. But you know, what I actually do when I make one of these games is I just have some things that I really care about for whatever reason. Sometimes I understand at least a little bit rationally why I care about them, and sometimes I don't. Sometimes they just are what they are. And I just sort of have faith that there are enough other people in the world who care about these things or think that they're interesting that they will get something out of the game, right? And, you know, so when I say speak to the human condition, it's sort of doing an extreme simplification of that, what I just said, but also widening the umbrella to cover what a lot of other people do as well that I don't do, right? So, for example, that game company... I would say that what they do probably falls under the umbrella of speaking to the human condition, but their emphasis is very different from mine, right? They're about, or at least so far, they could change tomorrow, but they're about making games that convey certain emotions, right? They're very emotional And emotion is always the point of their game or is the core of their game. Mm-hmm. Whereas for me, I would not say that that's true. There's definitely emotional stuff in my games, but the point is often maybe a little more intellectual, or at least the intellectual shares the floor with the emotional.
Right.
And so what you get out of that is very different styles of games, but you know, when I go and I speak to an audience who's maybe not that familiar with these games, I need to have a way to talk about that, right? And it's a very, you know, I don't actually use that phrase very often. I try to use, or I don't know what I use usually. I'd have to go through all my talks. But, you know, speak to the human condition is kind of an unsatisfying phrase somehow.
Sure. Yeah. And I, you know, I would imagine you could line up a lot of really interesting artists. I mean, I would imagine Hemingway would have hated that phrase, you know, like there's just a people who get up in the morning and go do what they do and they make things, you know, we can sort out who among them are artists. But I would imagine it's often the case that good art is not produced by people who are speaking to the human condition, quote unquote, right?
Yeah, yeah, totally. And fortunately, Hemingway probably didn't ever have to get up and give lectures about anyone ever want to write a story, right? Whereas it's a different world we find ourselves in now. But so the tie in there is that story version one of this game, really story version zero, because we never quite recorded this one and you know, had it voice acted. But you know, I wrote a bunch of stuff and some of it ended up in story version one, and it really was kind of trying to speak to the human condition, right? I mean, you know, I was like, these are the themes that this game is about. And it came from a very legitimate place. It wasn't artifice, right? It was like, this is really what I care about, and this is what I'm going to make the game about. But because I had not made a game with very serious audio logs in it, and in fact, there are very few examples of a game, you know, that has audio logs where the story is not like, oh my God, the aliens are attacking, he's eating my leg or whatever, right? There's very few examples to draw from. And because I'd never made a game with audio logs at all, like I didn't have a good feeling for how things would come across, right? And so the story version one still had at least some elements of this very early trying to talk about issues thing in it. And it just, I would watch people play it. Like GDC this year is the first time people played it. And whenever they got to the audio bits, I would just cringe. I was like, oh my God, this is unbearable. But even before that, like when I would go to, there's like websites where you can go listen to pre-recorded auditions from voice actors and stuff, right? To see if you want to hire them. And, you know, I was going on those sites, and even to press the play button to listen to a voice actor read something which had nothing to do with anything I was doing, right? Like read some random piece of script as a demo. Like I almost couldn't press the play button on the website. It was so painful, right?
Yeah.
And I didn't know what was going on there at the time, right? I thought I knew. I thought it was just, well, this is very personal material, and I feel like there's a danger that, you know, people will think my writing is not good or whatever, and so I'm just really worried about that. That's in reality not at all what was going on. What was actually going on, I mentioned earlier that I think my subconscious is a lot smarter and all-seeing. Or at least in certain ways seeing. And I believe what was happening is just that a big part of my mind knew that this track for the story was not where it was supposed to go. Like it was not what this story needed to be in this game in order for it to be the right thing, whatever the right thing is, right? And so, you know, we went for another version of the story. You know, I was working with someone to help write it. And we ended up veering more back in the direction of an entertainment story, which I think was an overreaction. I was like, oh, this really didn't work. I have to go back and sort of make this intricate plot with a bunch of characters. And, you know, you find out about this conflict that happened.
Right.
And actually, a lot of that is still in the official story now, but there it was like explicitly revealed in these tapes. And it was much more of a model of like, what's going to happen next? You know, what happened as a result of this argument that these guys, you know, when he stormed out, where did he go? And, you know, that kind of thing. And that's again, what I'm saying now is an oversimplification. It was actually a pretty smart story and kind of sophisticated, but it was an entertainment story again. And it just felt like not the right thing. And so just a couple weeks before this press tour, I was like, oh, okay, I'm gonna give it another try now that I know how to do this. And it's funny because I knew how to do it all along, but like, it's just in that way that like sometimes we believe that we know something, but then when we sit down to do it, we don't apply that knowledge we supposedly have, right? Like we do something totally different. Mm-hmm. So here's a mini segue. There's a radio show that I like a lot called On Being. Do you know that?
No.
It's a podcast. You can find it on the web. The host is a woman named Krista Tippett, and she interviews people from a variety of sectors of life. Spiritual people, maybe scientists, maybe just regular people living in a tough part of the world, maybe philosophers, right? And just getting their picture on just what the world's about, basically, right? It used to be a much more of a religious show, but it sort of evolved into being something less religious. I'll just leave that there. Not being able to find the right word. But I was listening to an interview with her way back before even Story Version Zero was finalized. And I forget who the interview was with, but she said that she pretty early on learned to apply a certain rule, which is that anytime you're talking about subjects like that, like, you know, you're interviewing somebody about subjects like that, like, you know, philosophy or spirituality or anything like that, the way that it works, at least the way that it works the best, or maybe the way that it works at all, is that you only ask them about the way that those things manifest in their life specifically, right? Mm. Because when you start speaking about very vague, like spirituality is like this, right, or, you know,
this
philosophy
is how the world
like
works.
That, yeah, it suddenly becomes very detached, and, you know, it can become preachy. It certainly becomes abstract. You start listening to it and you're like, why should I care about this, right? And it also, I don't think she said this, but my viewpoint on it is that it also, that abstraction layer introduces a certain amount of dishonesty, because, you know, us people with our ego structures are very good at reinterpreting facts and observations to suit what we want them to suit, right? And so when you're talking about these abstract things at a high level, what you're talking about is sort of the result of all that negotiation process within your psyche, right? And it's just very easy to come up with like processed cheese whiz kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Which is all a roundabout way of saying that the version of the story that's in there now actually applies what I call the Tippett rule, and only speaks of these things in very concrete ways with reference to things that actually happened. So it tries to sort of make a scaffolding around these ideas, or, you know, some kind of manifold around it in a way that is much more genuine and much more heartfelt. Mm. And, you know, when you go and you play one of the audio logs in this game, right away, it's very clear from minute one that the bearing, you know, the way that they're delivered is very different from the way that games usually do it. You know, most games are very presentational.
Right.
Even a couple of the games, so, you know, Dear Esther is one of my favorite first-person games. Hopefully some listeners are familiar with that.
Oh, I'm sure they are, yeah.
They're about to release a revised version later this year, actually.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, it's going to be, actually, Indie Fund is helping to fund completion of it.
Oh, wow.
And it's going to be, you know, it's got much upgraded graphics, and they're re-recording the audio, and it's going to, instead of being a mod that you have to sort of painfully install, it's just going to be straight up for sale on Steam.
Oh, so that's awesome.
That's going to be really exciting. But even Dear Esther, which I think is one of the best written games, I could probably just say the best written game that I know of, best acted and all that stuff, is very presentational, right? It's beautiful and it's poetic, but it's like, it's just what games do, right? So you play something like BioShock, and it's like a dramatic radio play that you're listening to in the audio tapes, right, and that's right, sort of the demeanor with which it's delivered. And it sort of has to be, right? With this game, it's different. With this game, it's just like I'm speaking very straightforwardly and very directly to you about something that I care about, where, you know, I, quote unquote, is the narrator of the game. And right away, it's clear that it's different and it works. And not only does it work now for players, but it works for me. Like I was saying before, how I was like cringing all the time and stuff. Now I totally don't. Like reporters sit there and play the game. And if I'm in the other room and I just sort of hear that they clicked on an audio tape right away, I'm happy. I'm actually not. I'm not cringing. I'm not worried about what they're going to think about it. I'm like, oh, great. They found that. Cool. You know, which is 180 degrees on the other side of the reaction spectrum. And, you know, the text is at the same level of draftiness or whatever. And it's not like I had a lot more practice to get over it. It's just that I'm much more at peace with what the text is in the game now than what it was.
Right, right.
And even if to the extent that even if you know, if people think that the writing is bad or that it's, you know, I don't know, like whatever, like could have been more skillfully done and like, oh, I'm so terrible. I don't think that that's true. But even if that were true, I would still be okay with it because the foundation of it is good. Like the content of it is what it needs to be and it works.
Right.
At least that's what I think today. You know, if you talk to me again.
Yeah, but I mean, you arrived at this point. I mean, writers write drafts, right? And this is, you've drafted a few times and you've come to a draft you like better, right? I mean,
I guess that's an explanation for it. But for me, I mean, the reason I just spent way too long saying that is just that it just feels like a very dramatic shift. Like, I guess there were three phases. I guess with the entertainment story one, it would have been okay because it was a good story. It was just, it would have been giving up on what I wanted the game to be.
Right, right.
And making something that I thought, so I didn't have to give up and now I have something that's good.
Yeah, which is cool because I mean, you know, I think people mistakenly assume drafting is just a technical exercise of, well, I'll write it three times, the third time will be better because I'll do a lot of cleanup or whatever. And, you know, what it's really about is learning what it is that you believe. Like, what is it you're trying to do? That the draft teaches you that, not so much where to put the words or whatever.
Yeah, but you know, the funny thing is, if I had told you what I was going to do, you know, back in 2008 when I got the idea for the game, or late 2009, I would have told you exactly what I've done now. Yeah. I mean, maybe not exactly, but like, it's going to be very heartfelt and straightforward and, all that stuff, but that's not what I ended up doing, and I was unable to see that that's not what it was for a while. It's crazy, but that's how people are.
In a kind of way, you're sort of an old school game maker in the sense that you program and you also design. You're also a game designer. Is that an important combination to you? You programmed almost all of Braid. Except, you know, I think you brought someone in the last few weeks, right?
Yep, friend of mine.
Yeah. Is that an important combination for you? Can you see yourself at a certain point doing less programming and turning more of that over to other people?
No and yes. So it is a super important combination, right? Because there's no communication barrier between having an idea for how a design should go and making it happen, right? You know, all the time in game companies, what happens is the designer comes up with some idea he thinks is cool and the programmer kind of doesn't like it or thinks it sucks and isn't that motivated and doesn't do a perfect job or maybe intentionally does something a little bit different because he's being passive aggressive and wants his version of it to get in the game. You know, like stuff like that just happens and happens. And even if they're good at working together, there's just a certain round trip time that communication involves. Right. Whereas I can just do stuff and it's very helpful. Like, I don't think Braid would have been nearly as good of a game. Well, assuming that it's good, because I don't want to be all like, you know, however good it is, I think it would have been much less good if there were a separate programmer and designer making it, whoever those people were.
Right.
Same thing with this game. The process of actually typing in the code is pretty important to understanding what the space of possibilities is. You know, it's just another direction in which you can think about the design and how these pieces of the design move and what is likely to arise. I will say my programming role has changed a little bit. So now, you know, one of the people in the core team is actually a 3D programmer who does, you know, high-end 3D graphics stuff.
Right.
And that means I don't have to do that stuff anymore. You know, the first year of development, I was like programming the shadow system and whatever. But now most of what I do is gameplay programming and like tool support programming and stuff for me. So I'm definitely able to type in more code. A higher percentage of the code that I type in now is directly related to the gameplay than it was on Braid, where that percentage is actually pretty small. So that's been nice. Hopefully I could keep that up. But there's this thing I've been thinking too, you know, like I said at the beginning, it's just been a long time since I first thought of Braid, and then now, you know, it'll be maybe 2012 and when this game ships. That's a game every 3.5 years or something, which is kind of a slow pace. And I would like to figure out how to do games faster, but I also, you know, don't want the quality to go down, right? So how do I do that? I'm not sure. You know, like one thing that's suggested is, well, you kind of do two games at once and they're staggered. So you start one and then while that one's finishing up or while that one's in production, the next one starts and is in early concepting phase and stuff. That can kind of work. But what I feel right now is that I tend to need all my attention on a particular game.
Yeah.
Maybe that's actually not true because as I say that, like I'm on this press tour, I'm in New York, you know, I'm not bad. So, you know, it's harder to run your company when you're like emailing everybody all the time and that's taking up a lot of time. So maybe that's actually not as true as I think it is, but I think it's true. And I think that if I were try to do two games at once, they would both kind of suffer. But I actually, here's where I go back and say art game again, because I don't know what else to say. But part of the reason why I feel like so much attention to detail is needed is because these are art games. And if I were to do at least one of the games as something that's not so much an art game, but is more in a different direction, like I've got quite a number of ideas for games that are like educational, but you can put educational in air quotes because what that really means is something very different from what we usually think of as an educational game, which is they tend to be terrible, and there's pretty clear reasons actually why they tend to be terrible. But I have a number of things that I think would be good and educational, or I should even say more educational, because I think Braid is educational. I think The Witness is educational. It's just the things that they are educational about are not necessarily the things that you usually think of when you think education. So these other games are about things that have applicability to the real world in a more obvious way than Braid or The Witness would. Let's say that. And because of that, because they're more pragmatic works than like artworks, then I could feel like maybe I could have someone doing all the work, all the programming work certainly, and maybe a lot of the design work, and I'm just kind of vaguely overseeing it to make sure it's kind of right. Maybe that's plausible, but then again, I don't know, man, because some of these things, they're really high concept, abstract ideas that require a lot of thinking to sort of make the rubber hit the road because they're just so weird. So I don't know. It bears being looked into.
Well, and you don't, I mean, some people kind of work in pairs, you know, they forge those early relationships and then they're kind of like joined at the hip and they have that kind of yin yang thing going and you can sort of divide up the labor, but other people are, you know, more lone wolves. You know, they just, it's hard to let people in, I think.
Yeah, totally.
Well, I can't thank you enough for this conversation, Jonathan. This is, I don't know how interesting this will be to you, but I was talking to Manveer Hare earlier today. Have you met Manveer?
Yeah, a number of times.
Okay, so yeah, I've got three sections of this podcast. I'm going to do all of them related to game designers and how you do what you do. And I spoke to Matthew Burns from Shade Grown. He works at Microsoft too. He's working on Halo 4. And he's cool because he's got sort of one foot in both. He's got a very small design studio, Shade Grown, making this game called Plonk. And then he's also, you know, making Halo 4. And then of course, Manveer's working on Mass Effect 3 and you. And one of the things that's just terribly frustrating to me about someone who's interested in games, game design, and kind of the whole picture is the incredibly closed blinds that always surround the game design process. And Manveer is the greatest guy in the world, but, you know, I can't ask him any questions at all about the game. And of course I can't. And I can't talk to Matthew about Halo 4 and And, you know, we've been talking, I mean, you've been very open about, look, I ran into this problem and I didn't like this and this was a failure and this was great. And I wish that we could have this conversation more often with game designers who'd be willing to just open up their process. I mean, there's lots of stuff you're not telling me and keeping things hidden for good reasons, but this is an important conversation to have, I think.
Yeah, the only things I'm really not saying right now are things that would be huge spoilers.
Yeah,
you know, here's the thing, right? A big part of the reason for the openness, I think, is because I started out as a tech guy, right? And programmers in games, for the most part, at least back when I started, were very open. Like, we would go to the game developers conference and be like, yeah, here's exactly how we did this very core technical feature that makes our game, you know, beat the competition, and now you guys can do it too. Like, we would just do that. And the reason is because technical people sort of understand that they're contributing to something, right? They're like contributing to what humankind understands, you know, even if it's in a small way in the form of, like, you know, whatever. And that's important, and that, you know, that we do a lot better sharing information, and we proceed a lot faster than we do otherwise. And also the fact that it's very obvious, any technical person who can program a video game did a lot of learning from earlier people who shared their knowledge and all that.
Yeah.
And so there are some companies who don't do that now technically, and that's a little bit of a bummer, but, you know, a lot of people still do. But for some reason, other fields aren't as open. Part of it though, you know, and I say this now as someone who is more thinks of himself more as a game designer than a programmer these days, but game design is really a lot of BS a lot of the time, whereas programming is an actual objective pursuit, right? So, like, if I go and I give a speech about, like, this is what I think is good game design, it's really kind of just my opinion, and because of that, I mean, that has all sorts of ramifications. Like, I think it means that design ideas don't develop and mature as quickly as programming ideas do and all that, right? But, you know, even despite that, for some designers, I bet actually that there's some kind of fear where if they feel like they spoke the real reasons why they did things and stuff, they would be exposed to criticism, right? But again, and that's the thing, like, programmers, we grow up in a world of harsh criticism. Like, that's somehow the programmer aesthetic is like, dude, that code you wrote sucks. Do it this way.
Yeah.
We're just very straight up about that. And, you know, other people aren't. But there's this other thing, if I can go and make a potentially culturally insensitive comment or whatever. this is, you know, I have to say something super controversial and I don't feel like I said it yet. So, you know, there's, for the past couple years, this is not news at all, right? There's been a number of Japanese designers lamenting the way that they're, not even just designers, but heads of teams lamenting the way that their teams are having trouble making games that compete with Western games in terms of, you know, technical complexity and all that stuff. You know, it used to be like back, you know, back even in the PlayStation 2 launch games, right? You know, you'd see these Japanese games with, like, characters with, like, faces that actually looked good.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Whereas in America, we had, like, the Quake guy. That was our idea of, a human character. He's, like, a 100 polygon, like, blocky thing. And, like, they had, like, hair that moves and all that. And you're, like, it was, like, how are they doing that, right? Like, in the mid to late 90s, I believe a lot of game designers would agree with me when I say that we just felt like, you know, Japanese designers were kind of kicking our ass. Like, we had some good games, but in general, you know, Western games were kind of clunky and had poor user experiences and, you know, were more buggy and whatever. And Japanese games were more refined and looked better and all that, right? And somehow those roles have reversed now. Hmm. And there's a lot of hay being made over this, right? Like, how does Japan get back on top and that kind of thing? And I actually think it's due to the fact that they don't have this kind of community where they share things, right? They're very trade secretive. Mm. And if you invite somebody Japanese to give, say, a technical lecture, first of all, it's difficult because it's going to be, you know, if they come and give it in America, it's going to be translated and that makes it slower, right? They can only say half as much stuff or whatever. But even accounting for that, they will generally not say anything that's all that useful or interesting. Right. You know, they'll say things that are kind of give the appearance of technical communication, but they're really kind of keeping the cards folded close to their chest. But I think that over the course of many years, that's had a detrimental effect on, you know, the level of developer knowledge, the level of tools that they have available, the expertise with those tools, just design best practices, all that stuff, right? That's just what happens. Because progress in those things is proportional to the size of the group. And if the size of your group is just the Capcom internal mailing list, that's much smaller than like all game designers in Japan or whatever, right? So I feel like, maybe this is totally untrue and it's just my warped view of the world, but I feel like we've already kind of seen what happens when people become more secretive. And now I sort of see American game companies becoming more secretive as the stakes have gotten higher. And I wonder if that's, you know, now 5 or 10 years from now, we're all going to be very sad because, you know, we are no longer that good at making games because nobody shares information.
Yeah, that, you know, Manveer, I mentioned talking to him, he talked about that as well, that it's the culture of certain companies, right? That Naughty Dog will come and bring their whole team and just sort of say, here's how we did this, 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 and this, you know, to GDC. And other companies just don't, or they just don't, they don't even let their people go to GDC so much.
Yeah.
So, well, I hope you're wrong about that, but I guess
well,
we'll
I'm not
find
saying
out.
It's for sure going to happen, but it does seem to be a trend that's in the process of happening.
Yeah. Well, and it's short-sighted too from the other side of it. I'm not a game designer, but in the community that I live in, we eat this stuff up. I mean, we're really interested in this stuff and we love having conversations, and I always feel very grateful that I'm invited to GDC, that I can attend these things and learn more about, so that I can, you know, sort of more thoughtfully write about this stuff. If I know more, if you tell me more, I can understand more why that's good or why that's bad or whatever. But you know, if you just keep everybody at arm's length all the time, it just doesn't seem like, other than protecting your secrets or whatever, it doesn't seem like very many people are served by that.
Yeah, I agree.
Well, once again, Jonathan, thanks so much for your time. And I can't wait for The Witness. I know lots of people are very anxious to play it. And I guess we'll be hearing more about it soon.
Yeah, you know, I think the embargo lifts an hour and a half from now.
Okay.
I don't know what that means in terms of when, you know, as we record this, right?
Gotcha.
I don't know what that means in terms of when people will post stuff.
Okay.
But yeah, in terms of playing it, it's going to be like a year or so. I'm sorry, okay. But it's going to be a while.
We'll but wait.
It's only so that we can make it good.
Okay. Keep working on it.
Yeah. Thanks very much for having me on.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Jonathan. And best of luck to you.